Do you know what I realized? After fighting about who was going to make the joke that the very first sin was a woman who ate, neither of us made it.
Wait, no, can we? And as you'll see, and
if you can make it work, I'll put it in.
And as you'll see from our discussion, and as you may have heard on TikTok or Instagram Reels lately, the first sin was, in fact, a woman who ate.
Ba-dum-tsh.
She left no crumbs and she licked the plate. Yeah,
there we go. Except in this case, the crumbs are body parts and the plate is society. Okay.
I love it. Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Drawing Blood Season 3. My name is Christy Slobogan.
I'm Emma Merkling.
And today we are primarily talking about the film Raw or Cov from 2016, directed by Julia Ducournau. And it's a body horror film that we use to talk about cannibalism, about disordered eating and gender and subject formation and identity formation and the terror of being a young woman. And this film follows a young woman named Justine who's just started at vet school. She's a strict vegetarian and she's joining her sister at this vet school. And over the course of the film, she descends into cannibalism just like her sister.
Yeah, and there's a lot of content notes for this film.
Yes.
We talk about disordered eating in quite graphic detail. We talk about rape. We talk about violence against animals. We talk about injury detail and acts of cannibalism, obviously. We talk also about self-harm. And if this is an episode that's going to be upsetting for you, maybe give this one a miss.
But we are both very excited about talking about this film. We both love this film. Love? Is that the right word?
Are fascinated by.
Are fascinated by this film. As usual, all of the text and movies and other pieces of visual culture that we discuss will be in our show notes and on our website. So let's get into it.
Yeah, I guess since it's the object that I'm bringing, in place of visual analysis, as we've done in other episodes, Christy, why don't you tell us what this movie is about? Or maybe tell us briefly the plot and then tell us what you think the movie is about. Because with horror, those are often two different things.
At least two different things. Yeah, for sure. So I'll do a very rough sketch of a plot summary, and then, because I'm sure that we're going to dig down into particular scenes throughout our conversation. But so basically, there's this young girl, she's 16, and her name is Justine, and she is going to this really prestigious vet school. She's getting dropped off by her parents. Her sister is already at this vet school, and basically this film follows her through the first week, which when I realized after watching it that what I'd been watching was only a week period of time, it kind of messes with you.
I know.
But it's hazing week. So she is dealing with these older vet students hazing her. And the important thing about her is that she is a vegetarian and she's a very strict vegetarian. Everyone in her family is a vegetarian. So one of the first things she has to do as part of this hazing week is eat a raw rabbit kidney. Everyone has to. And things kind of spiral from there. Spoiler, by the end of the movie, she is a cannibal rather than a vegetarian. So she has swung to the opposite end of the spectrum. So yeah, it's this really interesting film about so many things. But for me, at its core, this is a film about eating disorders, right? Mm-hmm. I cannot watch this film without reading every scene as a parallel to an eating disorder, as a metaphor for an eating disorder, yeah, as a straight up, equivalent to an eating disorder. That is what I see throughout this whole film. And it's so focused on gender. Let me just, just to give you a sense of how kind of obsessive I got about being like, okay, no, this is what this film is about to me. I have this unhinged list of all the reasons of why this film is about an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Okay. So reasons that this cannibalism is a metaphor for, you know, something like anorexia or bulimia, right? Okay. It's all about her relationship with her mother and her sister. So it's about socialized female relationships. It's something that is hidden at first. There was a lot of vomiting and restricting. It's also not only familial, but it's also related to kind of having a social in with this hazing. So it made me think constantly about like sororities and how disordered eating is often, you know, framed or encouraged in these very particular social spaces. Constantly you have in this movie conversations about the need for control that then spirals into a complete lack of control, which is often how eating disorders happen. You've got it occurring in someone who is very high achieving with perfectionist personality traits. Like that is very common in narratives of eating disorders. It's tied to shame. Oftentimes vegetarianism or veganism or saying that you're gluten-free is a cover for having an eating disorder. So that's what I was thinking about the whole time. And then there's quite often this imagery of two fingers or one finger. And the two finger is such a trope of bulimia, of like making yourself purge, right? And so I was just, we're going to talk about fingers, but like.
Okay, good. Because I was like, oh, I have things to say about fingers.
Okay, great. So yeah, for me overall, I mean, we'll get into all of that, I am sure. But for me, this film is all about an eating disorder. And then the secondary meanings are, you know, the pressures of being a woman and of being a daughter, mother, and sister. But those are all tied up with each other. I'm going to take a breath now because that's a lot.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I mean, absolutely. There were moments in the film where I was like, the way that they are collapsing cannibalism onto disordered eating. And specifically, I think the binary poles between binging or purging and restricting or abstinence, that was very clear to me. What's really interesting to me, though, with this reading is, for me, disordered eating is one of the tools that the film uses at some points more vividly than others to explore the themes I think it is interested in. But I think it is one of the themes. And it's definitely the reason it's such a good theme, and maybe even, as you say, the central sort of theme to talk about the things I think the film is about, is because it has to do with these things about excess on the one hand and abstinence on the other, because it has to do with control. And I guess for me, and I'm sure we'll get to this as we sort of unspool this film and this conversation, the film is about three sort of entangled themes, or the main things that I drew out of it after watching it a couple of times are girlhood slash coming of age slash coming into your desire, which especially has to do with coming into your body on the one hand. As I said, sort of excess and abstinence, both in terms of food, so, you know, like vegetarianism or not eating on the one hand, and then the extreme of cannibalism or the uncontrolled desire, the uncontrolled urge on the other hand, but also in terms of looking and, you know, some of the visual techniques that this film deploys. And then finally, and perhaps for me, most overarching me, bodies or embodiment in general and subjects and subject formation. And for me, the key thing there is the sort of structure the film sets up, where you have this hazing ritual, which is like a ritual of control and of trying to make everyone, you know, in this very sort of old-fashioned, almost Foucault way, you know, like the prison or the school, like this old structure where everyone is meant to be assimilated and become the same. And then the ways that individuals are within the system, both capitulating and resisting. And I think that what makes the film really interesting to me is it doesn't always follow through to a conclusion, any of sort of the strands that it draws up. And I think it has a very ambivalent ending, but I think it's a film about morality. And I do think all of these things are linked to these things that you've brought up about gender and the body and disordered eating. But that's my sort of teaser for some of the themes I'm interested in.
No, I like all of that. And I can definitely see how our readings kind of overlap with one another. And I do think that, like, if you're saying that the film is about morality and excess, like, there's a very strong, you know, moral reasoning, you know, when folks are struggling with eating disorders, with like what you can eat, what you can't, and kind of the frameworks around that, whether they're socially or individually imposed. So I really like what you're thinking here.
So I thought that I'd maybe give a brief background to the film before we get into it.
Yeah, that would be great.
So as I mentioned, this is Julia Ducournau's first feature film, and she has called it a deeply moral tale. So this is not just my interpretation of it. And it's really interesting to me how it fits with or plays into the lineage of some of her other films. So before this, and supporting very much your reading and this intuition about some of the themes of this film, her first film is this, I think, TV movie called Mange, which means eat. And I haven't seen it, but it's about a person with bulimia, I think, who wreaks revenge on her tormentors.
No way.
In high school. Yeah, you should watch it. Okay. If you feel strong enough at
See,
some point.
And
maybe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then the film that comes after it is called Titan, which is much more obviously a love letter to master of body horror David Cronenberg, although I think that's also going on in Grave. And that film is also in many ways about empathy and the monster within. And it does really interesting stuff with gender and subjecthood and transness. She sort of seems to see the subject as in some way always already trans, because that film is about a young girl who has a titanium plate in her head and basically, to cut a long story short, fucks a car, which is very David Cronenberg, and then gives
very
birth.
David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And gives birth to this baby that is part car, part human. But in fact, the story is a sort of redemptive story of love between her, who has a really complicated relationship with her biological father, or actually perhaps I should say them, because the pronouns, I think there's a very interesting gender slippage in this film. But between the central figure, who's called Alex, and one of the interesting things that the director does is she reuses the names Justine, Alex, and Adrien across both films. So there's something really interesting going on with subjecthood.
Well, that's so fascinating.
Yes. So in Titan, Alex is wanted for murder because they're a serial killer. And they decide to disguise themselves as Adrien, who is the son, this boy who was lost, who disappeared as a child. And Alex shows up as sort of the later version of this boy and develops this relationship with the boy's father that is one of deep love and acceptance and empathy. And there's this incredible scene where Alex drops the towel that they are holding up, and the father sees that they have breasts and this pregnant belly and says, "You are always my son." So there is something very, you know, I think I bring this up to say that I think she's very interested in some of the themes of gender, of the body, of what is the human body and what is humanity, and empathy, that I think are very key aspects of this film.
Yeah, and I think it might not be, you know, a central concern, but I do think that there are a couple of scenes that like flirt with being about transness or queerness. Like, it's not as explicit as you say her later film is with that idea, but I do think that some of that is at play in... you keep saying Grave. I only know this film as Raw because that's, you know, I watched it with subtitles, but that's, you know, how it was pitched to me on Apple TV where I rented it. And so I keep thinking about it as Raw, but like, to me, Raw works better as a word for this film.
So I think I use Cove for two reasons. One, in all the readings I've done, even if they've been in English, they're using the original title. And I also think that there is something interesting in the wordplay in the French word grave, which on the one hand has to do with the serious, right? If something's grave, it's very serious. It also is colloquial, a way to say like, are you crazy? Like, t'es grave, you know, like, are you nuts? Are you mental?
That's good. Yeah, I like that.
And you said you prefer raw.
To me, raw is like, she's so young. She's so green.
Yeah.
She's raw. Like, she is experiencing these things for the first time. Like, we are, her skin is raw. The meat that she's eating is raw. It also makes me think of like people who go on raw diets where yeah. you know, you can't eat anything cooked, which really is what animals eat. But I do think it's interesting that we have these two kind of different takes on this film, and we're also thinking of it with two different titles. I think that's really cool, actually.
I mean, it's also, the word raw is very visceral, right? In a way that, I don't know that Kave is necessarily. And I think the film's visceralness or its viscerality is really important. Notoriously, the director hates it when people bring this up, apparently, but two people fainted in its at the TIFF festival in Toronto where it was first screened. She has said before that she wants it to be a film that addresses itself to your body. And I think it very much does that.
Yeah.
The film is part of a genre that is sometimes called the New French Extremity. And it is this exact sort of body horror that, yeah, that is not just located in France, but a lot of its most famous directors are French. You know, think Gaspard Noé, Claire Denis, lots of female directors, which I think is really interesting. And it's basically this, it refers to this really deeply, excessively violent turn that is taken in sort of French art house cinema in the 1990s, late 1990s, early 2000s, that is all sort of about breaking taboos. There's very graphic images of violence, especially sexual violence, a lot of explicit sexual imagery. And, you know, of course, in many ways, this conflation of violence and sex is not new, especially in French culture, not French culture, but, you know, French fiction. I'm thinking of like Georges Bataille, for instance, in his pornographic novel, The Story of the Eye. And then tracing that back even further still, obviously, there's the Marquis de Sade, from whom we get the term sadism. And in fact, the name of the principal character in this film, Justine or Justine, is also the name of Sade's first novel, which is about a young girl called Justine who sort of is introduced into the world of vice.
That is so interesting. I love that you've just told me that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And basically, you know, there's obviously a longer history of like extremely violent and sexually explicit films. You know, there's Salò by Pasolini, for instance, from the 70s. But what film scholars like Oliver Kenny have identified as the shift is that the newer films are sort of more stylistically, we're talking about proximity, visibility. We're looking at things really close. We're lingering on things happening for long periods of time in extreme close-up, in extreme detail. And they're less sort of explicitly capital P political than the older films where violence is mobilized in this way.
Okay. That context of, as you said, New French Extremity is really interesting. And I love that you emphasize that there are many female directors in this, because what is more metal or more horrifying than being in a woman's body? Like, not only the violence that happens, you know, periods, childbirth, menopause, etc., but the violence that can always be done to a female body. I mean, that is just, I mean, it makes so much sense that this is being spearheaded by women directors.
And there is, we will talk about it, but there's a strong line through this film of discussions of rape, although not, I think, any depictions of rape. And one thing that's very interesting to me, you know, I think the horror of girlhood has something to do with something that these films sort of, expose in some way, which is that so much of what we go through is hidden and isn't discussed and is taboo. And so much of this film and the other films in this sort of genre are about the unleashing, the making visible, the forcing you to watch the horrors that are a part of being in a body.
Absolutely. And I know the one film from this tradition that I knew of when you said that you wanted to do an episode on Raw and that I recommended that you watch, and I know you did, is In My Skin, or Dans Ma Peau. In My Skin, unlike Raw, which is all about cannibalism and vegetarianism and sadism in a way, like inflicting this violence on other people's bodies, In My Skin is about inflicting that violence on your own body. So masochism in a way. And it is, I mean, even more so than Raw, I think, difficult to watch. Like, it's often on the lists of most horrible, most gruesome horror films.
It's the hardest film I've ever had to watch. I love horror, and I can deal with a lot of body horror. I rarely have to sort of look away. In this, in Dharmapur, I didn't only have to look away. I had to like take off my headphones at some moments because the sounds were so horrifying. It is visceral.
I never have to scroll my phone when I'm watching movies, and I never do. But I had to be like mindlessly scrolling the news or something to get out of this. But anyway, so In My Skin is about this woman, Esther, incidentally also the same name of the main character in The Bell Jar, and I think that's on purpose. But she rips her calf open at a party. She falls onto some metal, doesn't realize that she has injured herself. And then once she does, though, she becomes fascinated with the interior and exterior of her body and in self-mutilation. So like Raw is an unspooling of going from the control of vegetarianism to the total lack of control of an unbridled cannibalism. In My Skin is this unspooling from a woman in a, you know, successful job, relatively successful relationship, to then just constantly needing to carve into herself, to open up herself, to be bleeding, just this absolute play with her own body and lack of control over her own body that she's trying to get at with this destructive exploration. It's also, like Raw, I think a rumination on lack of control versus total control and how neither can be totally great for our psyche, basically. Yeah.
I mean, and I think in my reading, that's also, which also I think maps onto my understanding of Raw or Grave, is that it's also very much a film about capitalism and this idea of consumption, actually. The consumption of the woman's body by the capitalist forces that underlie it. Because the narrative of the film, besides or intertwined with, you know, the body horror sort of self-cannibalism stuff, which in Grave that is this thing about hazing in the vet school, in Dharmapur it's about her job and she's climbing the career ladder, and that involves men treating her like a piece of meat and looking at her a certain way and her having to behave a certain way. And as that intensifies, her self-consumption intensifies.
Absolutely. I think both of these films are comments on women's places in capitalism, like being able to have it all.
Yeah, being able to have it all. Also, like when you're at a banquet and you can have it all, have all the food on your plate, like really, you know? And
absolutely.
And I think that one of the reasons I would recommend both of these films, even for people who are not normally into body horror, is that I think that they do very interesting things with empathy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, like, in both films, there is this funny thing happening between being forced to look and wanting to look away that feels to me profoundly related to subjecthood in some. Do you know what I mean? Like, seeing someone going through something that sometimes makes you feel shame, that acts on your body, that makes your cheeks flush, or that makes you squeam and squirm in your seat. There, and both directors, I think they linger on the face. Like as these graphic injury details are happening, there is also a looking at the face of the subject. And we've talked before about how cinema uses the face. And I think these films both definitely do that to encode a certain subjectivity, to make us feel like we understand that we can read the individual's body. But I think that's definitely going on here.
Absolutely. And I think it's key that you said, you know, seeing these things evokes this kind of bodily reaction and this empathy. I've done some work on like the history of empathy, and I always find it so fascinating that, so empathy is a new emotion, right? It was first coined in 1908, and both Rob Bottis and Susan Lanzoni have written about this. But empathy is an emotion that was first tied to art, to being able to see into a work of art and feel what the depicted subject was feeling.
Wait, like, that's empathy, so interesting. I didn't know this.
Yes, empathy was a term. It was an aesthetic category, right? It was being able to feel into a painting, like when you get overwhelmed in an art museum, right? Like that was how empathy began. And it was something that was separate from compassion or sympathy or pity because it was bodily. You had this bodily reaction to a work of art. So it's so interesting that the visualizing of these horrible bodily experiences is so important. Like you talked about sound earlier, and yes, sound is important, but unless you're seeing the face or seeing the body or seeing these things happening, you're not able to feel into that person's experience. Like empathy is often framed as putting yourself in someone else's shoes, right? Yeah. But it's also like being able to visualize yourself in that person's setting. So whether that be a painting from, you know, the early 20th century as it was first understood, or being a horror film today, maybe body horror films are the logical culmination of this kind of empathetic way of seeing, you know, the most extreme, the most bodily, the most, you know, physiological of reactions. Like maybe that's what we're getting at here. I don't know.
Yeah. And then there's also something, there's something really interesting about how empathy is generated visually. And I think that it's done in ways that appeal to our other senses. And it's something that film is always extra good at, because you have movement and sound and sight and almost all the senses activated. But unlike, for instance, a theater performance, the director can zoom in, can force you as much as possible to look and to see. In a theater, you still have some autonomy. You can, like, your gaze can scan the stage. You can choose to look at someone who's not doing anything in that moment. But cinema commands you to look. And I read a very interesting essay for this show that I feel like I haven't quite digested, to use an apt metaphor.
Yeah, I was about to say, that has to be pun intended.
Yes. By Anat Pick, called Vegan Cinema. And it raised a lot of questions. Like, I'm not sure I entirely understood it. I feel like I need to go back and reread it a couple of times. That's why I meant I haven't quite digested it yet. But it was talking about this Simone Weil idea of looking as consumption. And this essay is encouraging us, and it's specifically about film, and it's asking us to rise to the ethically imperative but practically impossible task of looking without consuming, of seeing something that exists beyond you and resisting this urge to incorporate it, to take it in, to take control over it, to digest it. And to bring it back to Grave, I mean, I think that there's lots of film history stuff that has to do with the politics of looking and the politics of looking away. And one of the things that it's worth bringing up from the start, and right here, I want to recommend this really excellent essay. I think the best essay I read on Grave, by Beugnier and Delanoë Brun. And as usual, we'll link to this in our show notes and on our website. And it pointed out some of the parallels between looking as consumption and the history of cinema and some of the treatment of animals in this film. One thing that I don't think they mentioned, but that I thought about a lot while reading it, is that film itself is not vegan. Like, there's animal products, I think gelatin, physically in film, like on the material itself. But as they point out, right at the origins of cinema, we have the camera being used as a tool of scientific observation and validation, but also as control. And the image that they point to is Muybridge's iconic,
yes,
moment from early cinema, where he photographed a horse running, and they point to a scene in Grave where
I wrote this down.
I loved reading this because it's so good. It's a moment of empathy. We hear Justine for some, I don't remember why. I think it's she, but she has this moment of heavy breathing, like this extreme anxiety moment, and she's breathing really heavily, and the camera, the shot cuts away from her to this horse, this beautiful horse that is running. And it's very much giving that iconic moment from early cinema where he photographed a horse in rapid succession to try and see how it moved. It's one of the earliest filmic images that we have.
Absolutely.
And they point out, they say that, you know, this work is associated with a, quote, proto-cinematic will to knowledge, which has to do with this idea of sort of trying to, you know, what these studies led to was the development of templates aiming to calibrate movement to the utmost efficiency. And they also link this to Foucault's discussion of the disciplining and training of the soldier, that there is this regulation and this control that is happening at this moment, in which cinema, in which film, in which photography and the camera gaze is fundamentally involved, that has to do with the regulation and control of subjects. And it is an animal body that they first use, but it quickly lends itself to controlling human bodies as well.
Absolutely. That's what I was going when, and I haven't read this piece that you're talking about, but when I saw the kind of visual nod to Muybridge in Raw, I was like, okay, but you know, we're in, I know that Muybridge also took similar images of, you know, humans walking. So right there, just by referencing Muybridge, this film is also equating humans to animals within this place where you would think about that a lot, which is vet school, right?
Oh, there's fascinating stuff with humans and animals going on in this film. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things that is happening is the hesitancy the film has about either equating or not equating them. And one of the key moments of that for me is this discussion that happens very early on about the ethics of raping a monkey. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
What a weird scene. So it's at the very beginning. They've just, all these first year vet students have just had blood poured on them. Very reminiscent of Carrie, the Stephen King film. So they're still in their bloody lab coats, which of course gives like mad doctor, mad scientist. But one of the vet students is talking really inappropriately about like, oh yeah, AIDS is because some guy like had sex with a monkey, isn't it? And he's also saying this like in front of Adrian, the gay character. And of course, there's some tension there. But then it turns into a discussion about, okay, is raping a monkey the same thing as raping a woman? And Justine, the main character, is like, yes, it is. And people kind of look at her like, what? And she's like, oh, but we're at vet school. Like, don't we all think that? Like, isn't that what everyone here thinks? Because we all are here to care for animals. And it's this really interesting moment. Oh, also, this is one of my moments where I was like, aha, this is what she's thinking about. But, you know, when Justine says like, oh, it's the same thing to rape a woman and rape a monkey, Adrian goes, oh, but it's not the same because the monkey won't turn anorexic and see a therapist. So like,
yeah,
this equation of sexual violence with restricted eating or sexual violence with eating disorders. And, you know, since Freud, like this has been a whole thing like, oh, you know, eating disorders are the result of sexual humiliation or sexual abuse. Obviously, there's a lot of nuance there and should be nuanced, and that's not the only thing, but that is definitely an understanding of where these things come from. And so from the very beginning of the film, you've got this setup, but it's all within like the equating of the human and the animal in this conversation about monkey rape.
And one thing that's very interesting about that scene to me, and I've seen the director describe it as a scene that for her showcases the naivety of Justine, the way in which she is not yet a moral subject, that or that she is still grappling with the complexities of some of the moral issues that I think this film brings up, you know, and there's an amazing moment, speaking of empathy, where it's zoomed in on her face and you see her sort of looking side to side as you see these people who clearly don't agree with her. But I think it's an excellent moment where for me the film is not, I think, interested in saying that humans and animals are the same, but, and this is my spoiler, and I know that I'm obsessed with Deleuze's Becoming Animal at the moment, but I think it is doing something else, which is that it is revealing like what sort of humans and animals have in common, which has been called by Matthew Calarco a being towards meat. You know, it is interested in the continuities between the human and animal. And that's where we have sort of the close-up shots of Justine going on to the close-up shots of the horse. And I will say that, you know, I mentioned some of these scientific regimes of control and disciplining. That is obviously codified in the vet school. I mean, I know that they are here too, as Justine thinks, like, treat animals. But the violence that is the ordinary, easy bodily violence that is wreaked on animals throughout this film, from the number that must have been killed to feed all of these students the raw rabbit livers, to the scene where Alex has her hand up a cow's ass, to
that was,
yeah,
I was like, why is this harder for me to watch than watching like people eat each other's flesh?
It's
like,
rough. It's rough. And the scene where the horse is being tranquilized is really kind of upsetting, even though it's for its own good, quote unquote.
Also, like the idea, you know, horse tranquilizer or like ketamine is such
I thought about this.
Like, you know, people talk about horse tranquilizers or ketamine like as this recreational drug. So like seeing it being used within the context that it's meant for was really interesting. Like, you don't see that very often, and seeing how traumatic it might be for the animal body is really interesting.
And then these are spliced with the party scenes, right? Where, which are also very, yeah. I mean, there's a fascinating, one of the scenes I think is one of the scariest in the film is not one of the cannibalism scenes, but where the rookies, the kids who are being hazed, are crawling silently on hands and knees in lab coats. And it's almost this moving mass. I mean, it really speaks to one of the things
terrifying.
That I think the film is interested in, which is this thing about hierarchy and the equality that our bodies put us into, because we are all meat on the one hand. Like, they are the animals in the film, in as much as they are prey animals, as the cannibalism in the film, you know, attests to, but also that they, you know, there is something as you said, horrifying about watching a cow's body be violated and about watching the horse fall, as there is about watching these students get hazed. I think it's interesting in the continuities between the two and where that leaves us in terms of how we think about ourselves.
No, I think those are really good points. And going back a bit to like the visualization of empathy, as well as this idea of women's bodies as animal, women's bodies as meat, it's so interesting to me, like experiencing something like Raw, which is, you know, a woman becoming animal by, you know, eating this raw meat, eating this raw flesh. And then I just recently read this book, Night Bitch, which is from 2021 by Rachel Yoder. And it's also, you know, same as Raw, about the neuroses of being a woman and being trapped. You know, this woman is very anxious and trapped being a stay-at-home mother to this kind of terror of a toddler boy. And then slowly throughout the book, she starts to turn into a dog, like a very feral kind of dog. But she gets patches of hair where they shouldn't be. She starts to have this craving for flesh. And I think it's really interesting how, like, both in literature and in film, this idea of a woman both becoming an animal and eating them is really affecting. She also, at one point in Night Bitch, murders with her teeth her own cat. And, like, as a cat owner and lover, I was reading this book and I was like, oh my God, I can't read it anymore. So it's interesting, like, the parallel between that scene in Night Bitch and, like, some of the scenes in Raw or In My Skin where I couldn't look. And it's this, like, really visceral woman, like, cutting into flesh with her own body, with her own teeth. And I just think it's really interesting, kind of like the different emotional valences that are also sometimes quite similar between reading about these kinds of feminine transgressions, bodily transgressions, and watching them. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
I mean, I think just mostly about things that lead on to one of the things I wanted to talk about, which is, where does the horror of cannibalism in here, what does it lie in? Because I sort of think that a lot of this is, on the one hand, about fears of losing control, which is very related to disordered eating, of course, you know, canonically.
Definitely, definitely.
Self-control, control by others. I mean, you know, that's one of the central dramas playing out in the vet school, right? Are these, both in the students who are being hazed and the animals, sort of who is in control? And also through the character of Justine, contrasted especially with that of her sister, Alex, who is also a cannibal, you know, to what extent you can control your urges. And one of the reasons I think it's sort of a moral tale is because Justine, more than Alex, seems not able to control, but chooses to control. She doesn't murder to eat. She's sort of bemused and horrified. In the first cannibalistic scene is a moment where she eats her sister's finger, and there's a lot of stuff with, like, animals and gender and beautifying in that scene. I mean, she's being bikini waxed for the first time and, you know, de-animalized in a sense, right? Beautified in a way that is like the removal of hair. And then there's an accident with the scissors. That's like a really tense moment in the film. And her sister's finger gets chopped off and she ingests it.
And then she eats, well, importantly, she first stops the dog from picking it up and eating it. And then as she picks it up, she's like, finger, snack. And it's such a great scene.
I think what is both interesting about cannibalism and sort of scary about it is, and this is something, one thing the director has pointed to is she says she's interested in cannibalism because, unlike zombies and werewolves, it's a real thing. I mean, Claude Lévi-Strauss is the person to read on this, as is Beth Conklin, who has a fantastic book called Consuming Grief, I think, which is about cannibalism among the Wari people of Papua New Guinea, that literally since like the first century AD, I mean, I think Pliny records it, in the West specifically as well, so we don't even have to orientalize it, even though we tend to, there has been a long history of people ingesting the bodies and parts of the bodies of others. And as Levi-Strauss points out in his essay, We're All Cannibals, all of us in some way, you know, do what he calls, what he defines as cannibalism, which is the practice of intentionally introducing into the bodies of human beings parts or substances from other human bodies. And, you know, in Western Europe, there's a practice of medicinal cannibalism, consuming the blood of recently dead people and the flesh right up through the 17th century, and even through the consumption of mummies in the Victorian period, you know, the 19th century and into the 20th. And people practice cannibalism for lots of different reasons. It can be a political tool. It can be part of a ritual. It can be to serve nutritional needs. It can be therapeutic. Organ transplants are one of the things that Levi-Strauss points out, is us taking in another individual's body into ourselves. And so I think that it does have to do with something we touched on in the last episode as well, is which is this fear of the losing, the fear and the power of losing the boundaries of the self. And I think that Kave does interesting things with that idea of that being a source of power as well. Because I don't think cannibalism is framed as a bad or even necessarily a scary thing in the film. And I think that the character of Adrien, who sees what she is and still loves her, is a really interesting symbol of that.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. And I'm just thinking, like, the scene that is making that what you're talking... Well, actually, first it's important to say, we didn't mention that the film actually opens with a car crash. And we find out later that it's because the sister, Alex, orchestrates these car crashes so that she can then eat the people who die in the front and passenger seat. So, you know, there is this idea that perhaps in the sister, this cannibalism is something uncontrolled and perhaps coded as morally wrong. Whereas with Justine, maybe it isn't. And the kind of line that sums this up for me also, again, relates to disordered eating or eating disorders, capital E, capital D. But Alex, the sister, says to Justine, did you lose weight? It's not a compliment. Mm-hmm. You better not become anorexic. And then Justine responds, I'm not like you. I don't need it. She never names it. I don't need it. I just tried it. And there's that equation, moral equation, perhaps, of like anorexia and cannibalism, where perhaps dabbling is all right, or like doing it for medicinal purposes is all right. But when it becomes compulsive is when it's not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And that for me, it's interesting you bring up that scene. That for me is the strongest argument for the eating disorder reading, because it is seamless. They're first, very clearly, they're talking about anorexia, and without changing topic, ending the sentence, it ends with her saying, you couldn't have tried something other than my finger, which is also, as you mentioned, very related to the imagery of bulimia. And there's a scene in the film where she's, oh my God, this was for me the hardest scene to watch in the film. She's been chewing her hair nervously, and then somewhat like a cat coughing up a hairball, I guess, she's pulling hair out of her esophagus. And she comes out of the bathroom, and this girl, this very lovely girl, says very kindly and then smiles, you know, two fingers will make it come up faster.
Yes, yes. And like, what better parallel do you have than that? Like, both female support, but for something that's very destructive. And one thing that I think is really interesting about that scene with the two sisters, where anorexia and cannibalism are very clearly equated, is that the sisters, is that it's a very visually pathologized thing. The sister sees her in the dress that she'd been wearing earlier, and that clothing is how she notices that, you know, her sister might be losing weight, which of course, clothing fitting correctly is a big reason why women end up, you know, having eating disorders or trying to diet. But I also think it's interesting in terms of like the long history of eating disorders, is that clothing is often used like in medical journals, in medical photographs, as the way to show when a woman has anorexia nervosa and has been healed by the way that different clothes fit. And I can link to some of these photographs, but like, you've got these differences between like in the quote unquote before images, these really skeletal women with like this diaphanous clothing falling off of their shoulders. And Susan Sidlaukas writes about this really convincingly, but you've got this, you know, diaphanous dress falling off the shoulders. And then in the quote unquote healed photo, when, you know, maybe they were just force-fed and, like, nothing has really changed psychologically, but then they are, like, filling out their dresses. So I also think, like, thinking about clothing as the thing that makes disordered eating obvious and that makes people comment on it is really interesting for me in that scene, and I think really important.
I do want to talk about the sort of this triad of figures. Justine, Alexia, her names are sort of interchangeable, and yeah. Adrien, who's her gay friend, because I think that each of them, they're the most allegorical figures in a way, which I think is also emphasized by the way that the director uses those same names in different configurations in later films. But for me, it like shores up this thing that I think is of like a central concern in the film, which is something to do with identity and subject formation, and how, you know, the three individuals each exhibit three very different responses to the hazing, the attempts to control them as sort of a unified entity that's happening. Alex capitulates. She fully sort of goes over to the side of the abusers, the hazers. You know, she refuses to practice empathy, frankly. She ends up becoming a murderer. There's this horrifying scene where she taunts Justine, who's extremely drunk, into with a cadaver, like with a human cadaver. And it gets in front of everyone. In front of everyone. And it gets filmed on an iPhone. And Adrien, her friend, shows her the next morning. And as a slight sidebar, but maybe something we'll get back to, there's this line. A boy sort of tries to push the camera away and he says, "Don't film." And then he says, "C'est pas humain," which either means it's not human, referring to Justine, who's like crawling on all fours after this meet, or it's not humane. Don't film. Turn the camera away. Don't look, you know, which I think really crystallized a lot of stuff for me. But so if Alex capitulates and it ends up sort of, spoiler alert, the culmination of the film after the sort of descent into cannibalism is that Alex teaches Justine how to quote unquote hunt. So Alex like causes these car crashes on these roads and then feeds off the flesh of the people who die, which Justine refuses to do. And then the way it all ends up is that Justine wakes up one day next to the body of Adrien, who seems to be sleeping. And they have also just had sex. And I do want to talk, there's more interesting identity stuff going on. Actually, I don't know if in that scene they've just had sex, but they have sex at some point in the film.
They had sex recently.
Okay.
And yeah.
Yeah. And so Justine wakes up next to Adrien, who's been really taking care of her and taking her in the whole film. And he, I think, does exhibit empathy. He's really loving. He's really caring. He tries to protect her, even though he is also sort of a liminal figure. And she pushes the sheets back and sees blood everywhere. And she sits up and she looks in the mirror, which is a really interesting reflection, both of the earlier monkey discussion, in which she actually says animals can recognize themselves in a mirror, and an earlier scene where she dances very sexily to this very explicit song with herself in the mirror. She looks in the mirror and there's this moment of horror, like, what have I done? And then what she realizes, to cut a long story short, is that it's her sister, Alex, who's killed Adrien and eaten him and eaten his thigh. And then
eaten a massive, like very realistic looking chunk out of his thigh.
And the film wraps up basically by, there's this moment where Justine places this implement, this rod that Alex has used to kill Adrien and then eat him. Justine places it against Alex's head, which reminded me of how cattle are killed, I think. But then instead of killing her, Justine lovingly washes the blood off of her sister. And I think the next thing we see, Alex has been arrested in prison. And I think one of the most telling shots of the film is the first moment we see of this. Their two faces are blurred, are merged on the reflective glass of the prison wall. So like Alex is almost this animal trapped in this cage is very much the imagery.
Yep.
And there's this really interesting, I think, once again, we're thinking about who has autonomy and how, because it's like they've all been hazed. Like Alex has been taken in and fully assimilated within this power structure. She's a horrible person towards Justine. She's the one who forces Justine to eat the kidney. There's a moment where it seems like she won't have to if her sister just says she's vegetarian, but then she does end up having to. And in this final scene, there's this, the way that their faces are overlain on each other, And then Alex looks down and you see that they're two different entities. Reminds me once again of the conversation we had in our last episode about sort of becoming animal or taking in the subjectivities of others, which of course cannibalism is a metaphor for, and the two radically different poles of what happens when you do that. Do you develop more empathy? Do you become a more moral subject? Do you recognize that we are all meat, us and horses and cannibals and even, you know, the people hazing us? Or do we kill? Do we sort of turn into abusers ourselves?
Absolutely. I think that's really good. And I think, you know, one of the most important elements of any person's subject formation and identity formation is the parental relationships. And the big reveal at the end of the film, Alex is in jail. Justine is back with her parents. And her dad says, you know, long story short, he says, "I'm sure you'll find a solution. Your mother was tough at first when I met her at the same vet school. But, you know, basically we figured out a thing that works for us." And then he lifts up his shirt and you can see all of these scars and some fresh wounds where it is so clear that Justine and Alex's mother has been slowly eating their father. And to me, this is what really drove home the eating disorder narrative, because so often, you know, young women's relationships with food are shaped by and influenced by their mother's relationships with food. And so many of those neuroses and disordered habits get passed on. And so, you know, so it's very clear that this cannibalism has been passed on from mother to daughters. And when I was watching this movie a second time, I kind of made note of all the times that this is hinted at throughout the film, even though you obviously don't know until the big reveal of the father, you know, showing his chest. But in the very first scene, when it's just Justine and her parents, you've got her mom making this big fuss about meat being accidentally in Justine's mashed potatoes. The mom is the one who's like, "That's not okay. You know, I'm going to take this back." Right? When Justine first sees Alex at the vet school, Alex says to Justine, "Oh, mom's got to you. I see. What has hell been like without me?" And that is, again, so like how sisters talk about the neuroses that their mothers place upon them, right? Like, oh yeah, we are both in this together. We both have the same disorders because of the way that we've been socialized. You know, they're in this vet school because of their parents and in order to please their parents, which is often how disordered eating happens. And there's a lot of mention throughout the film that like, this is a really prestigious school. There's a lot of pressure and they're doing this, not only Justine and Alex, but other students are doing this in order to please their parents. The mother is framed as overbearing when they pick Alex up at the hospital. And in the very, very last scene, which is again, the overlapping or the connecting between eating disorders and cannibalism, right before the father shows Justine his scars and his wounds on his chest, the mother is like, "Okay, don't get up until you finish your veggies."
Yeah.
And I'm like, that is so often that kind of attitude towards food in households with daughters, that like, you have to eat this, you can't eat that, like this restriction and control, you know, good and bad moralizing of food is so often a reason for disordered eating in young women. And so I thought for that, as you said, the other scene really crystallized it for you with the filming, like that scene is what crystallized it for me. I was like, this is all about mother, daughter, sister relationships. This is all about how we get socialized to eat in a disordered manner. This is how like the female body is read and how, you know, obsessions are passed on from generation to generation. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, I last thing, and then I'm done saying all of my becoming meat animal stuff, but he says, when he says, "I'm sure you'll find a solution, my dear," which I think is the closing line of the film. He says "ma puce," which means my dear, but literally it also means my flea. Anyway, that's just like a...
That's so interesting. And one thing that I thought about with this closing line as well is there's this big debate, you know, so you'll find a solution. But there's this big debate right now, and I've been reading these articles. There's one in the New York Times recently, you know, like in the bioethics spheres about whether you can class an eating disorder as terminal, whether you can call something like palliative psychology, right? So you can say that you have terminal anorexia, and whether that's even a justifiable or, you know, ethical diagnosis is really interesting. And so to me, when he was saying that line, I'm like, or so have we said that Alex's eating disorder is terminal and Justine still should be like trying to find a treatment for it? Or like, what is the line for when it becomes something that is no longer treatable? And that's what I was reading into his, like, you'll find a solution, you'll get through this, you'll find the right meds or the right, you know, psychiatrist or whatever.
Yeah, but there's no meds. It's all about self-control.
Right.
You know, which is like the self, the thing that feeds back into itself. And one thing that I think we've danced around a lot in this discussion, but maybe not said explicitly, but this final scene with the father brings it up, is the extent to which this cannibalism and the appetite that is depicted is all about female desire as well.
Yes.
And I would love to hear you more on desire and disordered eating, because I think that it's a super interesting sort of complex thing. But from the start, the way that these cannibalistic urges and feelings are merged onto Justine's desires, the monstrosity of being a teenage girl, of coming into all these big and scary feelings, jealousy and lust and revenge and love and empathy, and trying to sort of claw your way through them to find some sense of stable sense of self. There's a fantastic scene where she's watching Adrien play football and it's clear that she's into him. It's really interesting. It's a desiring lens that is turned on him that is mostly used on women, where he's like playing football and at first it's like it's his face and his chest and eventually his crotch, and she's staring at him so intently and then she begins to get a nosebleed, and it's just so good. And that final scene where the dad's chest is all chewed up and his mouth, and he says that he basically implies that with their first kiss is when he realized she was a cannibal, that what cannibalism is in this film, among other things, is the monstrous female desire being released. And I don't mean monstrous as a pejorative, because I think that very much in this film, it's saying, yes, it's monstrous and it's us. This is all of us. That is the position of empathy from which we should be behaving.
Absolutely. And I think a word from an article that I really thought was helpful, it's a piece by Erin O'Connor, again, about photographs of anorexia nervosa. And she says that in these kinds of depictions of female disordered eating or female desire, the female body is always proto-pathological. And so the expression of this desire is when it becomes pathological. And I think a lot of what we've been talking about today is like the collapsing of this pathologized desire for sex, for food, for consumption, for freedom, for, you know, for everything. And you see that in Raw, where sex and food are conflated. You see that in My Skin. And I think you see it most clearly in, you know, I was talking about novels that fit into this kind of genre, but in novels like The Vegetarian from 2007, where sex and rebellion and eating, like deciding to be a vegetarian or deciding to like refuse certain things, are all collapsed into one another.
Mm.
Like that novel is where you really see this correlation between eating, sex, and rebellion. And that's where it's made explicit. Whereas, well, I guess it still is really explicit in Raw, but it's just interesting to see that this is such a trope that we can understand and that we can, you know, perhaps empathize with.
There's this interview where the director says she only picked vegetarianism because it felt funny that it was like the opposite of cannibalism. But I'm like, actually, to your point, Christy, about disordered eating, the opposite of cannibalism, which is consuming the body parts of other humans, is not eating, and in turn, letting your own body be eaten away. Like, that's disordered eating.
I totally agree. And the fact that she picked vegetarianism because she thought it was funny because it's the opposite of cannibalism is like, to me, I would have picked vegetarianism, like I said earlier, because it's so often a cover for other neuroses or other types of disordered eating.
I mean, what it makes me think of is that, you know, the challenge for Justine, as for most women, because I think the stats, I mean, show me a woman who does, or someone who has raised a girl who does not deal with disordered eating of some form. But, you know, the challenge is not to find a normal relationship with food or with her cannibalism, because what is that? What does that look like? In what world does that exist? Just like we can say, map the same thing onto the desires that she is having to learn to get under some form of control. You know, what is a normal relationship with desire? The fact is more, I think the challenge is more to find some kind of livable life, some kind of ethical life, and that that has in some way for me to do with getting out of some of the binary strictures that are being placed on her in the film. Either, let's say, to capitulate on the one hand, which leads to the complete destruction of the self and, like, ironically or counterintuitively, the unleashing of this wave of, you know, unethical behavior and, like, this torrent of, like, murderous rage and violence from her sister, you know. But it's also sort of, I think the character of Adrien, just to sort of to close on him, is very interesting in this regard, because he is a figure who, despite the fact that he is gay, as he identifies in the film, and says he spent 20 years hiding in that way, there's a moment where he has sex with her. And there is the sense that to occupy a fluid identity, you know, to realize that you don't have to be, as she is at the beginning of the film, a capital V vegetarian, and you don't have to believe that raping a monkey is the same as raping a woman to behave in an ethical way. To me, that is sort of the way out that this film finds in a funny way, that, like, maybe there is a way to lean into that continuity and that fluidity of being and of being in a body, that is the solution, I guess, to the problem that the film poses.
The solution, as her father frames it, like, that's the solution that she'll find.
Yeah, or I guess that's the solution. I don't know. I think she's finding it. I don't think it's going to be easy. And I think that it doesn't give us an easy ending. It doesn't give us a clear ending. The ending's really sad. Adrien is, like, one of the kindest, loveliest characters, and he's brutally murdered, but she chooses care. She doesn't go on a murderous rampage. Like, there's this moment where you think, is she going to destroy her sister? And she doesn't.
Absolutely.
Shall we wrap up?
Yeah.